Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa sallallahu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa sallam. First of all, really want to thank Dr. Jones for agreeing to come on. I know it's late there in Scotland, so really appreciate the time. But Professor Jones is a professor of English literature at St. Andrews, which is a very, very notable, I think it's one of like Oxford of Scotland, isn't it? It's considered one of the great universities of Oxford, and the British Isles take the English language very seriously, so it's hard to get a position of that stature without being a very formidable scholar of the English language. And I think that is very well proven in this extraordinary edition, which is not just an edited edition, but really an amazing, I think, just an amazing presentation of the work. I learned a lot of things. I've loved Pope for a long time, and there were lines from this and also from some of the Dunciad and other things that I actually memorized many, many years ago, and have quoted for people that, you know, have heard me. I've quoted Pope in public lectures, this rereading some of these things, just I think it was Ezra Pound just said that a book at 50 is not the same book that you read when you were 20 or something like that. So these books are wasted on young people who still read them in college, because there's so much richness in this. So I just, for me, I have to say, you know, without and this is not flattery in any sense, but I have to say this is really one of the finest pieces of modern scholarship that I've read. And I just think it's a amazing work. So I'm going to there's some of the passages that I'd like to go over. But before we do that, what I'd like to say, one of the things that I was curious about was the introduction did not have a lot of biographical data on Alexander Pope. And he has such a fascinating biography, because he was from a persecuted sect in England, wasn't permitted to go to school really, and became this extraordinary autodidact with just a vast erudition. And I think you really did him justice by, you know, the level of erudition that you present in the annotations and in the introduction. So I'm just curious, maybe just a little biographical data and how you feel that influences him as an author.
Thank you. Yes, so Pope was born into a Catholic family in the 1680s in England. As he was growing up, Catholics were excluded from various areas of public life. They were excluded from the public schools, from the universities, and from participation in government as well. And Pope, like many others, was very antagonistic towards the new dynastic regime, the regime of William III that came in 1689, by many in England hailed as the start of brought about an English revolution, the foundation of a balanced constitution in Britain, and by many celebrated as a wonderful period in British history, but for Catholics thought of as a time of repression by an aggressively Protestant king who also went to war in Ireland, which has a majority Catholic population and was quite oppressive. So in his early days, he experienced or felt that England was maybe not necessarily a very, very welcoming place for people of his sect, and felt perhaps slightly oppressed. And many have argued that Pope was keen in theory, if not necessarily in practice, in restoring the other royal line, the line of the House of Stuart, which was a Scottish royal family that had ruled Britain previously. So his father was a cloth merchant. So he comes from a kind of trading background, a modest, financially modest background. But his father was a successful merchant, and he moves out to the countryside to the west of London and meets older men, aristocratic men, literary men, and is very early in his life brought into a world of quite intense literary study and scholarship. And one other thing that marked Pope's early life, he said, was that one of his earliest forms of reading was reading the religious controversies between Protestants and Catholics. That his father had a great deal of this pamphlet literature in his personal library, and Pope digested that when he was very young. So I think, although, and this is something we may talk about later, Pope's religious consciousness isn't always front and centre of his writing. Even in this poem, his great ethical poem, he doesn't always come across as a strikingly religious figure or a figure whose religion is very strongly committed to a particular sect of Christianity. Nonetheless, when he was young, he really imbibed that sense of religious controversy. He had a period up until about 1714, when Queen Anne was on the throne, when I think Pope felt very much at the centre of British life, of British politics. He had a group of literary friends, very famous writers like Jonathan Swift as well. And at that moment, I think Pope felt very central. But following the death of Queen Anne and a change in the politics, again, Pope started to feel a bit more excluded. So his mature writings, many of his mature writings from the 17 teens onwards to the end of his life in 1744, are slightly written from the outside. So he takes a satirical attitude towards the mainstream culture of his day, and is quite a critic of manners, of politics, of literary culture more generally. Maybe that's enough on as a starter on Pope's background.
I think it's also fascinating that he suffered from Pott's disease, so he had this horrible scoliosis, and I think apparently he was about 4'6", which probably would have been quite just difficult. And then being a great satirist, and mocking so many people, I guess he created so many enemies. So there's definitely a rebellious streak in him. I just thought of just the mentality of somebody who is an oppressed minority, and kind of a little bit lashing out at the dominant culture. And pedantry obviously was one of his great, just really set his sights on the pedants of his time, and there was a great deal of that, I think, in the English tradition. So I just thought that was really fascinating about him. One of the things that I wanted to ask you, because what's fascinating to me about An Essay on Man is, and I followed it up with after Marcus Aurelius for obvious reasons. It's to me, the Christianity is so in the background, if it's almost there at all. And I know he was criticized for that during his life. I mean, a lot of some of the more staunch theologians deemed this actually kind of a dangerous book almost. But what fascinates me is it resonates almost perfectly with for Muslims. Just in terms of his views on certain things, that, and almost Quranic, to be honest with you. I mean, there's some, and I'll get into that I'm just fascinated by what you think, just as somebody who's so steeped in him, just as a religious, quote unquote, religious writer, because, I'm just wondering, what your thoughts are on that.
I think this is a very interesting question. I'd be extremely interested to hear from you, Sheikh Humza, and from the rest of the group, where those moments are, what the possible kind of Quranic echoes might be. I think Pope is certainly a believer. I think he does believe in one God. Some passages of the poem suggest that he might either he didn't express himself clearly, or that he might have entertained the idea that God was not completely distinct from the created universe, but maybe within the created universe. And I think that's one of the the more controversial ideas that the God was the soul of the world, a great Stoic idea. Maybe Pope didn't distance himself quite enough from that idea to satisfy his Christian contemporaries. I think he certainly believes in a providential universe, and I think that's to my mind really the central concern of the Essay on Man, is to demonstrate the goodness of God's providence. Pope is, one of the things that characterizes earlier 18th century Britain is an intense fear of the social disorder that can follow from sectarian divide, because there was a civil war in the middle of the 17th century, and people were keen to avoid the severity of religious conflict that could issue in civil war. Right. So there tended to be, for reasons of social cohesion, a tendency to emphasize those points of religion held in common.
Right.
Which can lead towards a very, the group of people are called latitudinarians. So
latitudinarians.
Don't mention too much about the differences between religious sects or even the great world religions, but just emphasize those points that everybody has in common. That again leads to an emphasis on natural religion, the religion that can be derived from observing the world around us, that doesn't rely on a particular scriptural revelation and so on. I think one tiny moment in Pope's poem where he comes across perhaps as Catholic. I don't think there are very very many moments in the poem at all of this kind. Is in the third epistle of the poem, around lines 225 to 30, where he says there are two ways that people identify God. One is through natural religion, through observing the world around them and deducing that it must be the work of a creator, a benevolent creator. And the other way is through unbroken tradition. Right. So handing down traditions from father to son. So it's not the same as a scriptural revelation necessary, but talks to the importance of inherited tradition in the Catholic Church as opposed to the inner light of the Protestant Church. So I think in very few moments in the poem one can get a sense of Pope's Christianity and even of his Catholicism. But I agree, one has to look quite hard sometimes to find it there.
Well, it's interesting because he, apparently he had a longstanding correspondence with Lady Montagu. And in there, he says in one of his letters that he was familiar with Islam because she was actually enamored of a lot of the aspects of the Ottoman Empire. And you know, even though it's a later, Locke was heavily influenced. There was a very interesting Oxford Don, Edward Pocock. Are you familiar with him?
Very, at a great distance, but I know.
So they actually have the Pocock Library there. But he had studied in Aleppo, Syria, and spent several years there. He was actually originally, I think, a missionary, but he brought back a massive Arabic library, manuscripts, and translated some of them. Henry Stubb at that time was also writing. Coleridge, there was a very interesting, in 1734, there was a very interesting it's the first real translation of the Quran. I mean, there's earlier ones from the 16th century, but the first decent one was in 1734. So he wrote this in around 1734, didn't he? 1735?
1733 to 4. Yes. So it's coming out at exactly that time. Yeah.
Yeah. So George Sale's Quran, which was the first translation I read, oddly, and I actually have an original edition of it in my library. But it's actually a really excellent, and I'm convinced that's where Coleridge got the ancient rhyme of the Ancient Mariner idea of the albatross, mm-hmm. because Coleridge was influenced by Islam and had read Sales' translation. And Sales has a footnote on, there's a verse in the 17th chapter of the Quran that we put an albatross around the neck of the sins of people, you know, on the day of judgment will be like an albatross around their necks. And that's what Sale says in the footnote, that this literally means a bird. But anyway, I found only one. There's an article that I found on Gale, academic article from two English professors at the University of Bin Talal in Jordan, called "Intertextual Reflections on Nature and Solitude in Alexander Pope's Ode on Solitude: An Islamic Perspective." So it's kind of an interesting. I wasn't terribly convinced by the argument because Pope wrote the Ode to Silence when he was like 12, I think. So I doubt that he, you know, I mean, they're making an argument that he was influenced by the Quran in that thing, and it wasn't very convincing to me. But I do feel that, you know, there was such a huge influence at that time of Unitarianism. There was a lot of very interesting ideas about religion beginning to come up with the Enlightenment. Mm-hmm. And so I do think that, you know, I'm pretty convinced that he must have had some exposure. And I think it's one of those areas that would be interesting to study.
If I may just mention one text, which is a text that I have looked at a long time in the past, but I don't recall it well, I'm afraid. But a man called Samuel Oakley in 1708 translated a work by Abu Bakr ibn al-Tufail.
Yeah, and I think Pope read that. Yeah.
He had a copy of it and from 1708, and that, so it suggests that he could well have read that book. And
yeah, no, I think he did
that in his mind when he was.
Yeah, because that's very much in line with the idea that people come to God through nature, because that's essentially the argument in that. We actually read that book at the college here. The students do read that in one of the, we have a cohort system, so they all read, it's a great books college, so they all read the same books, which is not that popular anymore. You know, there was something that really struck me in your introduction. I just thought it was just such a fascinating, I hope I can find it here. It was I think a quote from Pascal about hierarchy in the world. He talks about the two carriages coming to the crossroad. Yeah, here it is. I it's on Roman numeral 80. So he basically he says that you say here, in order in the poem was discussed above. In Epistle 4, order means social distinction, a rank ordering of people that will produce order as equality indirectly through hope and fear. Pope holds the view that equality in the distribution of goods would lead to conflict, but fortune's gifts, if each alike possessed, and each were equal, must not all contest. Such attitudes may well be responding to Thomas Hobbes' assertion of the fundamental equality of all people, and therefore the necessity of conflict. From this equality of ability ariseth equality of hope in the attaining of our ends. And therefore, if any two men desire the same thing, which nevertheless they cannot both enjoy, they become enemies. And in the way to their end, which is principally their own conservation, sometimes their delectation only, endeavor to destroy or subdue one another. Hobbes is a believer in a fundamental equality, the conflictual consequences of which are prevented only by social compact. Pope's sympathies are in a different direction. This was what was so fascinating to me. There is a struck through note in the shoulder of the manuscript page on which a version of a couplet just cited occurs, which reads, "See peace, Pascal." And I guess that's, yeah, from the Pensées. The earlier of these citations from Pascal's Pensées concerns the wisdom involved in venerating customary human distinctions. The second provides a reason. How wisely, Pascal from the Pensées, how wisely has it been ordained to distinguish men rather by the exterior show than by the interior endowments? Here's another person and I disputing the way. Who shall have the preference in this case? Why the better man of the two? But I am as good as a man as he. So if no expedient be found, he must beat me or I must beat him. Well, but all this while, he has four footmen at his back and I have but one. This is a visible advantage. We need only tell noses to discover it. 'Tis my part, therefore, to yield, and I am a blockhead if I contest the point. See here an easy method of peace, the great safeguard and supreme happiness of this world. And then you write, the superficial approval of social distinction is common, but the underlying philosophical reasons for that approval are different. Pope's text adds to Pascal's sense of the practical value of social distinction, an argument from the assumption of God's legible rather than hidden providence. Given God's justice, it is simply impossible that evident inequalities in the distribution of material goods could affect the happiness of the individual. You know, that this, it just really struck me, was so fascinating. I was once in Saudi Arabia, and they have a, like the British system, they have the roundabouts. So, you know, I had such a hard time understanding, like, right away there, because it's a little crazy. And I asked a Saudi friend of mine, you know, who has the right of way in these roundabouts? He said, the Lexus first, and then and then the BMW, and then the Mercedes, and then the Chevy Impala, and then the other people. And it just totally, and he was partly being facetious, but also partly stating a truth. That is much more evident in certain parts of the world than it is in the West, which has become increasingly more egalitarian, at least in its presentation. I think there's still, we all see the hierarchies and the class systems, but nonetheless, there's this idea one of the things that I knew America was going down a different path when I took my children to this one of these theme parks that my father had taken to me to as a child, and there was a fast lane for people if you paid more. So when I was a kid, everybody had to stay in the same line, but now, if you had more money, you know, you, so I just realized, oh, okay, it's very different. You know, if you look at the difference between first class, like 40 years ago in America, and first class today, just completely different. There wasn't a lot of difference between first class and economy. So I just thought that was really a fascinating point that he was making. And, you know, do you have any reflections on that?
Yeah, sure. I agree. So it's very interesting. I think Pascal is he presents a God who cannot be known. There is no point in humans thinking that they can arrive at an understanding of the attributes of God or the qualities of God or understand God's ways. That's really something of a different order of knowledge. Thomas Hobbes at the other extreme, as you were just citing, really doesn't want God in his in the picture of the evolution of human societies that he's presenting. But and I think Pope is somewhere in the middle. And Pope says this of his own poem. He's trying to steer between extremes and find a middle ground, find something that everybody will agree in. So he sees the value, the social value of there being order, of there being a hierarchy, because that it puts people in their place. The person with four footmen goes first. The person with three footmen goes second. And it's simple. But he, unlike Pascal, simply being happy to say this is a merely human thing, and perhaps doesn't relate to God's justice at all. We can disregard. It's not a case for God's justice to be invoked. Pope does want to find a reason. He wants to find a reason for order and attribute and say that it's got something to do with the way God's made the world. Yeah. And one of his reasons, which hasn't convinced people, not all people, right from Pope's day, is that those people who get to go first will always be worrying about losing what they've got.
Right.
And those people who are last will always have the hope that one day they'll go first.
Fear and hope.
Yeah. And it's that balance of hope and fear that equalizes happiness, even though people have very different conditions in the world.
Well, yeah, great point. That's one of the things Thomas Sowell here, one of our economists here, talks about, you know, that what America provided for poor people was the hope of actually becoming middle class or even wealthy at some point. And obviously the rich people have the fear of losing their wealth and losing their position. So, you know, for me, the single most profound in this entire work for me, and I'd be curious to see what you found maybe in your deep reading of this amazing poem, what you found, what struck you as something that really profoundly struck you as being important and deep. But this is a very Quranic, because the Quran says we raise some of you over others as a test.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's several verses that deal with this hierarchy in the Quran. Another one says that we made some of you a test for others. Will you be patient? And in the commentaries, they say the rich are a test for the poor are a test for the rich, the ignorant are a test for the learned are a test for the ignorant. But what's interesting is there is a kind of deference to things like wealth and things like, they're not seen as important, but they are seen as social distinctions. And the rich are told to have compassion for the poor. And obviously charity is a major theme in the Quran of like helping people in less, because there, for the grace of God, go I, this idea that, you know, that could be you. You could have been ensouled in a poor person's, and your wealth has nothing to do with you. Like it's seen as it's a tribulation from God. But what's interesting is in the Islamic tradition, in the afterlife, it's reversed. Like the rich people wish they were poor, because the poor people enter paradise 500 years before the rich people. So it's everything's reversed. So the man with the four coach, you know, four footmen and four horses, going to wish he was the one with the one, you know, coachman. So it's, and, you know, obviously a Marxist reading of that would be, oh, well, yeah, it makes perfect sense. You know, this is social control. But what's fascinating for me is that these ideas came out of the crucible of persecution, that religions, even though governments use them as social control, they did not come out, the prophets that brought these traditions were persecuted peoples very often. They weren't in power. It took Christianity 300 years before it got into power. In Islam, it was not anywhere near, it was much quicker, but these verses were revealed in the crucible of persecution. So it's a very interesting thing, but I'm curious to what you would have to say about just what struck you. What I was going to say, what hit me was the idea of the equality of happiness. And it really gave me a different perspective on, and I'm wondering if Jefferson might have even been influenced by Pope, because I'm sure he'd read him. But when Jefferson said, you know, all men are created equal and are endowed by the Creator with certain inalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Mm-hmm. Like we have that, you know, Pope's argument, and obviously you showed other people before him who had put this forward, but his argument that there's an equality in the ability to be happy, that a pauper can be as happy as a monarch, and a monarch can be as miserable as a pauper. You know, that just struck me as just incredibly profound.
Yeah, it is, and it's people. So Samuel Johnson, one of Pope's near contemporaries, slightly younger than Pope, coming to eminence in the later 18th century, says he thinks it's because Pope hasn't seen poverty that he can dismiss it. Johnson feels quite easily. He can say, well, it's okay to be poor because you have then the hope of being rich or of having a better life. Samuel Johnson's sense of that was he just hasn't really seen that amongst the poor. That isn't something that for him characterizes the psychology of the poor. But Samuel Johnson famously likes to spoil people. I think he had a very, very pessimistic view of human nature in general and thought happiness was not to be attained anywhere, really, for humans. Pope perhaps has that slightly more optimistic edge. He wants to see the possibility of human happiness because he has, I think, a strong fundamental belief in the benevolence of God and the providential organization of the world. And as for many of his contemporaries, it just seems so. But there has to be some kind of explanation for this problem of calamitous virtue. The fact that good people that we see around us are made to suffer. There must be a reason for that, and he's seeking that reason. And he finds that way. One of the things that has always struck me is very. Very important about this poem and very rich is another way in which Pope is trying to see the benevolence of God and of God's providence in creating the universe. And it perhaps tends a bit more towards some of the more enlightenment ideas we see in Pope, getting towards the idea of human science, of the human sciences, a kind of slightly more detached view or study of human nature, but it's more around the beginning of Epistle 3, which is where Pope deals with humans in society. And what I find, I'll read a bit of the passage if that's okay. And one of the things I find interesting about this is Pope uses the language of what in his time is modern material science, people who talk about the universe just as matter, as atoms bumping into one another and creating by chance what we see in front of us. He uses some of that language, but he turns it towards a picture which is one of God's love. So he says, look round our world, behold the chain of love combining all below and all above. See plastic nature working to this end, the single atoms each to other tend, attracted to the next in place, formed and impelled its neighbor to embrace. See matter next, with various life endued, press to one center still, the general good. See dying vegetables life sustain, see life dissolving, vegetate again. All forms that perish, other forms supply. By turns, we catch the vital breath and die. Like bubbles on the sea of matter born, they rise, they break, and to that sea return. Nothing is foreign, parts relate to whole, one all-extending, all-preserving soul connects each being, greatest with the least, made beast in aid of man, and man of beast. All served, all serving, nothing stands alone. The chain holds on, and where it ends, unknown. So this passage speaks to me a lot because...
one of my favourite passages.
Yeah, it's wonderful. It has that... It takes the language of the materialists and says, well, I can use that language too, but I'm going to give you a picture of God's love and of human love as well, making societies work, making the universe work. And I feel whichever faith you're of, or if you're a person of no faith, there's still something there you can see. You know, who wants social discord? Who positively wants pain and misery and suffering to be amplified and generated? Who wouldn't prefer harmony and order and mutual support and benevolence? And I think there's a picture there of how one can move from looking at the world around you, trying to understand its principles of operation, and come up with a course of action as an individual and as a society and as a social group that leads to good outcomes. So. That's great. One passage, it speaks great to me.
Yeah. Well, I think two responses to that. First, who would want discord? Well, the masters of war, certainly. I mean, there are people that love to rile up two groups and then sell weapons to them. You know, so unfortunately, you know, Raytheon, General Electric. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, CEOs out there that they just start seeing great opportunities when strife breaks out. The second comment about what you said about Johnson, who, you know, I lived in with Bedouin in West Africa, and essentially they're like homeless people. You know, I mean, homeless people set up tents, and like we have a whole tent city out here in California because we have one of the largest homeless populations. You know, I lived with some of the poorest people on the planet. And at the time, Mauritania was considered, I think, maybe the third poorest country. They've since discovered a lot of natural gas. But what struck me is how joyful these people were and how genuinely happy they were. And I think one of the worst things about our culture, Western civilization, is we don't have dignity in poverty. I think there probably was in the feudal system more dignity with the poverty, but maybe I'm being nostalgic, I don't know, but I have seen dignity in poverty in many places in the Muslim world, and I really haven't seen it, with rare exception, in the West. There's something very degrading about poverty, and I think it's partly because of the deeply materialistic aspect of the you know the modern culture. But yeah, I don't agree with Johnson on that at all, because I really have seen what we would consider real destitution in terms of just material. I mean, people that everything they owned was in a small box, and yet they had smiles etched on their faces. You know, I mean, I literally knew people there that just had permanent smiles. They were just happy people. So anyway, the introduction is just, it was just so rich, and there's just so many things in there. But going to the some of the things that, I love this passage here. It's on page 11. Then say not man's imperfect, heaven in fault. Say rather man's as perfect as he ought, his knowledge measured to his state and place, his time a moment, a point his space. If it be perfect in a certain sphere, what matter soon or late or here or there? The blessed today is as completely so as who began 1,000 years ago. I love that passage. That's a very Muslim passage, because Imam al-Ghazali said that this is a perfect world for the purpose of the world. And man was created with a perfection for the purpose that man was meant to serve. So that's a very Muslim view of you know people. There's a verse in the Quran in Surah a chapter called the Dominion. It's a later chapter, but earlier it was revealed early, where it says you know that God created the heavens and the earth, and you will not see any flaw in the creation. And then it says, look again. You know, in other words, with that first look, that's what you're going to see. You're going to see all these flaws. Mm. But it's saying, look deeper, look again, and your eye will come back weary from trying to find a flaw. And then also this, another on page 13, hope humbly then with trembling pinions sore, wait the great teacher death and God adore. What future bliss he gives not thee to know, but gives that hope to be thy blessings now. Hope springs eternal in the human breast. Man never is, but always to be blessed. The soul uneasy and confined from home, rest and expatiates in a life to come. It's a beautiful, passage. I mean, some of these, they're just so stunningly, and obviously, I mean, you've shown the, you know, I always, when I taught a freshman seminar, And I would show them the rough draft. We have a rough draft of the Declaration of Independence. You know, it's a great, if you've never seen it, it's worth looking up because it's, you know, everything's like crossed out and new word. Originally, it was life, liberty, and the pursuit of property, which was Locke's, you know, and I guess Jefferson nicks that one, being the philosopher that he was. But yeah, I just, amazing. You know, just the let's see.
Pope's manuscripts for the poem did have quite a lot of crossings through as well. So it took him a long time to get to these precise formulations of these phrases. And that's one of the phrases you'll hear people use in the UK still. In if someone's
yeah, hope springs eternal.
Hope springs eternal. People say it every day.
Yeah. Yeah, learning, a little learning is a dangerous thing. I mean, he really gave us quite a few, you know, just very memorable turns of phrase. Yeah, quite stunning. You had a wonderful footnote on page 19, 190, which is about the bliss of man could pride that blessing find is not to act or think beyond mankind. And it's is not to know or think beyond mankind. Pope removes the contradiction of man knowing what man can't know by revising to act, which suggests impersonation or stagecraft as well as agency. The bliss of man could pride that blessing find is not to act or think beyond mankind. The cleaner text makes this couplet a contradiction. Man could never think beyond man. Montaigne of moderation, a man may both be too much in love with virtue and be excessive in a just action. Holy Writ agrees with this. Be not wise that you should, but be soberly wise. The citation is probably Romans 12:3. For I say through the grace given unto me to every man that is among you, do not think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly, according as God hath dealt to every man the measure of faith. For a contrasting view, see Montaigne of experience. No generous mind can stop in itself. It will still pretend further and beyond its power. It sallies beyond its effects. Montaigne apology. Anyway, it goes on. But I just thought that was such an interesting, you know, annotation on that, on what he's saying. Because, again, the Quran says you've only been given a little bit of knowledge. You know, there's this idea we in our tradition, God is there's a transcendent and then the immanent perspective. And the transcendent in our theology, they say whatever occurs to your mind, God is other than that. So God is beyond concept. We cannot conceptualize God. God is outside of binaries. There's actually a verse in the 47th chapter that says we created everything in binaries, and then it says, and there's nothing like God. In other words, there's no binary there. And so that unknowability, you know, that the human, we read one of the books we read was Bartleby the Scrivener. You've probably read that, Melville.
Pretty good. Yeah.
So I used to teach that. So I've read it several times, and I felt like I really finally nailed it. You know, this last reading, because you know, the character, the owner who hires Bartleby, he's constantly commenting on his you know, he thinks he's got them all understood, except for Bartleby. You know, he's just like, it's constantly driving him nuts. Like, what's going on with it? You know, these people that we have in our lives, like some people we just get, we know, you know, what you see is what you get. They don't have a sleeve to wear their heart on. But then there's other people that you're just like, what is going on with this person? You just cannot figure them out. And at the end, I just felt like Melville was saying, you know, ah, Bartleby, ah, humanity. It's that what that man never understood. You're lucky if you work yourself out in this life. You know, if you can come to self, not don't even bother trying to know anybody else. And I feel that's a real theme in this book. you know, is in this poem. Is any thoughts?
I think you're quite right, and Pope takes quite a big subject. I think he invokes Isaac Newton, you know, the first person really to quantify how gravitational force operated, and to set it out in very precise mathematical terms. And he says, you know, Newton might have been able to work those things out, but could he describe even a single movement of his own mind? So that same kind of warning to be humble in the face of your own being and the source of your being, I think it extends through this poem. And Pope's always, he's telling people not to be prideful. Don't imagine that humanity has now arrived through science or any other means at a way of understanding all there is to be known about the universe. So don't think beyond yourself.
Right.
But at the same time, and this is one of the things I find very interesting about the poem as well, is that he says, don't think beyond yourself. But at the same time, the poem invites us to extend ourselves to be better versions of ourselves. So we shouldn't rest easy with who we are, because we should strive to be the best kind of human that we could be, to have the best appropriately human view. But we shouldn't think beyond that. So, you know, there's a challenge there, I think, again, for that anyone can pick up, no matter what their faith background or their political background. You know, you want to be the best kind of person you can be. But where's your limit? When have you overstepped into arrogance or pride or making false assumptions or acting on behalf of others when you have no right to, perhaps? So, yeah.
Ghazali has a great poem, Imam al-Ghazali, one of our great scholastics and mystics as well. But he has a poem where he says, you know, you ask where is God and you don't even know where you are. Like... in this great universe, like, what are your coordinates, you know? And then he says, you drink your water and you don't even know how it comes out the other end, you know, and you want to know, like, who God is. To that, what you were just speaking, self-love is, you know, his take on it is so interesting. Like, you know, narcissism is obviously a perversion of something which is natural, which is to love yourself. And then, you know, the kind of Aristotelian moderation, like self-love is necessary, and the extremes would be narcissism and self-loathing. And so finding that, but he's using it to really, you know, he says on 36, self-love and reason to one end aspire, pain their aversion, pleasure their desire. And this is, again, very, you know, the Muslims pretty much, and the Quran, I think, concurs with the Platonic view concurs with the Quran, to say it more appropriately for us. This idea of a ranking, you know, that reason is given to govern appetite and irascibility, and irascibility is to ward off harm, and appetite is to accrue benefits, and obviously pleasure being one of them in moderation. And then he says, our greatest evil, or our pleasure, or wrongly or rightly understood, our greatest evil or our greatest good, modes of self-love, the passions we may call, 'tis real good or seeming moves them all. But since not every good we can divide, and reason bids us for our own provide, passions, though selfish, if their means be fair, list under reason and deserve her care. Those that imparted court a nobler aim exalt their kind and take some virtue's name. Just fantastic stuff. Yeah.
Yes, I think Pope is trying to work out how those... The desire to preserve one's own existence, that desire. He thinks God has clearly implanted that in people. Look around. That's just something that people want to do. It must be to some end. It must be to some purpose. What goods is this form of self-love doing? And provided as you say, there are rational limits set upon it, or there are and reason in this case is perhaps not cold, but is quite again, it's quite loving, it's quite sociable. As long as my self-love doesn't detract from the right to exist, the means of existence, or the of other beings, then it's a reasonable form of self-love.
Right. And he'll obviously develop that further. He has some really wonderful things to say about moving from self-love to love of our fellow man, and then to extend it beyond even to you know, the animals and the world itself. On page 46, this was another fantastic for me. Virtuous and vicious every man must be, few in the extreme, but all in the degree. The rogue and fool by fits is fair and wise, and even the best by fits what they despise. 'Tis but by parts we follow good or ill, for vice or virtue self directs it still. Each individual seeks a several goal, but heaven's great view is one, and that the whole. The counterworks each folly and caprice, that disappoints the effect of every vice, the happy frailties to all ranks applied, shame to the virgin, to the matron pride. That, you know, it reminded me of the web of our life is of a mingled yarn, good and ill together, you know, in Shakespeare, that this dialectic in the poem is very strong between the isthmus, you know, this human being that is kind of an interstitial space between the angels and the beasts, and rising to this higher nature is the struggle. And that's where I feel that he's less Christian, in that the salvation for him is through the practice of virtue, that he's really calling us to being virtuous human beings and fighting these downward pulls. But, I just thought that was such a fantastic.
Yes. Yeah. Discouraging people. Yeah. Discouraging people from thinking they can be good all the time, in the same way that no one person is all kinds of people. An individual person will be some days good, some days less good, some days positive. And great encouragements to introspection and humility throughout the poem.
And then on 48, he's got this wonderful just about the toys. Some strange comfort every state attend, and pride bestowed on all a common friend. Some see some fit passion every age supply. Hope travels through, though quits us when we die. Behold the child by nature's kindly law, pleased with a rattle, tickled with a straw. Some livelier plaything gives his youth delight, a little louder, but as empty quite. Scarfs, garters, gold amuse his riper stage, and beads and prayer books are the toys of age. Pleased with the bauble still, as that before, till tired he sleeps, and life's poor play is o'er. I mean, there's obviously resonance with Shakespeare there, but I found there's a verse in the Quran that I just thought it was so almost, you know, it says that, you know that the life of this world is but play and amusement. And then ornamentation, and then vying with one another in children and in the acquisition of wealth, and then it says it's like a rain that comes down and the green sprouts up and it's beautiful, but then you see it wither and become chafe and then blow away in the wind. I mean, it really struck me. Like that passage is so similar to that verse in the Quran, this idea of play and then, you know, as children and then entertainment, like children amuse themselves. But then as we grow older, we need, you know, entertainment. We need to be amused, you know, by other plays and novels and television now and these type things. So I thought that was just a really fantastic.
I think he's quite, in some ways, quite well. Interesting that he includes beads and prayer books as the distractions of later life. So he, in a way, it's a critical attitude to the mere display of
religion.
Yeah. When you get old, if you start to worry about your death then and what's going to happen next, well, then you're just distracting yourself with another one of the toys that's appropriate to a stage.
And there's something horrible about people that find faith in old age and then become, you know, these kind of, you know, judgmental people that are like condemning the youth for sowing their wild oats when they were doing the same thing when they were young, right? I mean, it's a very common trope. Fantastic. There was a few other things I wanted to, before we open it up for any questions. So many great lines in here. I mean, I just... What was your favorite section? Because it's considered an incomplete poem. Like he wanted to add more to it. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, he has these ideas throughout his life of writing a very full book of poems, which not this was in some ways he called it like a scale on a map. So this was the abstract part, and then he would move on to much more practical questions of how to live a particular life. But he didn't necessarily finish all of those. I really like the third epistle. I find that very, very interesting, where he gives a historical account of how societies emerge, and it's partly mythical, and it's partly, you know, probably the best guess at the time of how human societies did start to make themselves. I think there's an interesting passage around line 241 of Epistle 3.
Which page?
It's page 67, sorry. Which is where Pope is talking about the moment where he thinks the first societies would have been patriarchal societies where a king was identified simply on the basis of strength and virtue. And that a kind of natural religion and close social ties would have gone along with that. But then he thinks it's part of the history of things that political organization tends to become corrupted. And this is his version of describing that. He says, "Who first taught souls enslaved and realms undone the enormous faith of many made for one?" So that is, rather than the king being the having the responsibility of his position, the king starts to think that the others are made for him, are made for his use. Who first came up with that proud exception to all nature's laws to invert the world and counterwork its cause? So then he gives an idea of how this might happen. Force first made conquest, and that conquest law, till superstition taught the tyrant awe, then shared the tyranny, then lent it aid, and gods and of conquerors, slaves of subjects made. She, midst the lightning's blaze and thunder's ground, when rocked the mountains and when groaned the ground, she taught the weak to bend, the proud to pray, to power unseen and mightier far than they." So I won't continue, but this is
Pope. Oh, fantastic.
How false religion and exploitative politics can go together in these early stages of human social development.
Well, that was one of my favorite passages. Fantastic. And very modern, like really. Mm. Yeah. These are very modern ideas, because this is at a time when the divine right of kings was just beginning to be challenged in Western society. I mean, he was born 1688, right? The year of the Glorious Revolution. So then Hobbes, I think, you know, I mean, Hobbes had already made his mark at just realizing, you know, the kind of harm that a lot of religion produced. And I think he's addressing that here in that passage, you know, just the abuse that power does. Also very interesting on 75, ask of the learned the way, the learned are blind, this bids to serve and that to shun mankind. Some place the bliss in action, some in ease. Those call it pleasure and contentment these. Some sunk to beasts find pleasure end in pain. Some swelled to gods confessed even virtue vain. Or indolent to each extreme they fall, to trust in everything or doubt of all. Who thus define it say they more or less than this, that happiness is happiness. Yeah, fantastic. And then this is where I just, wow. This just floored me here. Equal is common sense and common ease. Remember, man, the universal cause acts not by partial, but by general laws, and makes that happiness we justly call subsist not in the good of one, but all. There's not a blessing individuals find, but some way leans and hearkens to the kind. No bandit fierce, no tyrant mad with pride, no caverned hermit rests self-satisfied. Who most to shun or hate mankind pretend, seek an admirer or fix a friend. And then order is heaven's first law, and this confessed, some are and must be greater than the rest, more rich, more wise, but who infers from hence that such are happier, shocks all common sense, heaven to mankind, impartial we confess, if all are equal in their happiness. I mean, that really just struck me as just such an extraordinary statement. Because, you know, we have billionaires that commit suicide and, you know, and paupers that flourish in their poverty with real joy. And I've seen both.
I admire the sense that the truly human goods, the goods of this world, at least, are always with and for other people as well. There's not an entirely solitary good. It can't be good just for you. That wouldn't really be a human, a truly human. That's debasing the nature of the human. If you think there are things that are truly good for you that you alone could enjoy, all real human goods are actually shared with others and have some sense of the wider world, of the social whole, of the way God's created the universe.
Yeah, and then again on 83, what makes all physical or moral ill? There deviates nature, and here wanders will. God sends not ill, if rightly understood, or partial ill is universal good, or change admits, or nature lets it fall, short and but rare, till man improved it all. We just as wisely might of heaven complain that righteous Abel was destroyed by Cain. You know, it's interesting you said, you know, in that passage you read earlier, who started it all? He asked that question. In the Jewish tradition, Cain did. And then whatever is right. This world, 'tis true, was made for Caesar, but for Titus too. And which more blessed, who chained his country, say, or he whose virtue sighed to lose a day? I loved your footnote. That was a wonderful Suetonius. I found my dad reading Suetonius once, and I asked him, he said, oh, he fills some lacunae that Tacitus and others miss, but not very often read. But I wonderful little note about on another that, you know, he was always doing favors every day. And on another occasion, remembering at dinner that he had done nothing for anybody all day, he gave utterance to that memorable and praiseworthy remark, "Friends, I have lost the day." What a wonderful, beautiful statement. The Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, he said that, you know, every articulation, every joint has charity written on it every day. So you should give charity for every joint in your body every day. Wow. Yeah, a wit's a feather and a chief a rod. An honest man's the noblest work of God. fame, but from death a villain's name can save, as justice tears his body from the grave. You know, the ending, I just, yeah, it was just, it was really that this section on 96, God loves from whole to parts, but human soul must rise from individual to the whole. Self-love but serves the virtuous mind to wake, as the small pebble stirs the peaceful lake. The center moved, a circle straight succeeds, another still and still another spreads. Friend, parent, neighbor, first it will embrace, his country next, and next all human race. Wide and more wide, the overflowings of the mind take every creature in of every kind. Earth smiles around with boundless bounty blessed, and heaven beholds its image in his breast. I mean, wow. What a vision.
Yeah.
You know, it's just
amazing. Up the universe. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's so beautiful. Just as, and then come then, my friend, my genius, come along. You know, O master of the poet and the song. And while the muse now stoops or now ascends to man's low passions or their glorious ends. I'm beautiful. Shall then this verse to future age pretend? Here we are, you know, a few hundred years later, reading. And I love how the great poets really know they're going to be remembered. You know, they just, Shakespeare has that, Homer has it. You know, they really have that wonderful recognition that it's not them. You know, the muse is working through them. And so there's kind of a, you know, there's an absence of ego. It's not like a boast. It's a recognition of something. You know, the muse was working here. And then, you know, thou wert my guide, philosopher and friend, that urged by thee I turned the tuneful art from sounds to things, from fancy to the heart. For wit's false mirror held up nature's light, shewed erring pride whatever is right. That reason, passion, answer one great aim, that true self-love and social are the same, that virtue only makes our bliss below, and all our knowledge is ourselves to know. Wow. Incredible work. Thank you so much for this, Dr.
Thank you for allowing me to speak with you about the poem.
Yeah, no, it's just, I mean, I was just really just affected by your work, and the annotations just opened up so much. So we can, we can open it up if anybody has any. I mean, it's a great opportunity with Dr. Jones being so steeped in this incredible poet.
Well, it looks like we do have a couple of people raising hands. So I can take Amir Hamid first, because he's had his hand raised a while. Amir, I'm putting you on.
Hello, Dr. Jones. Thank you, and assalamu alaikum to everyone else. Thank you, Zaytuna, for organizing this, and for Dr. Jones for joining us. Your introduction is, I think, an incredible contribution to the scholarship. The previous people whom I've read who talk about an essay on man, there seems to be an understanding that the poem is it should be read as a poem, and I think Harry Solomon in The Rape of the Text talks about how we're not doing that, but no one seems to come up with a model in terms of how it should be read as a poem, and I think yours does that, and I think you have this wonderful line in your on Roman numeral page 24, the poeticalness of Pope's text is intrinsic to its essayism, and it seemed to me that you were the way that's the case is that it's more of a communicative, in a more of a communicative way, these subtle changes of tense and mood and some of the rhythm and stress. I was wondering if that could be pushed further in terms of there's this J.W. McHale in his lectures on poetry, in his definition of poetry, he says, if the technical art of poetry consists in making patterns out of language, the substantial and vital function of poetry will be analogous. It will be to make patterns out of life. And I was wondering if he's using poetry, maybe not just as a communicative device to be able to make these subtle shifts and for ambiguity and these things, but and maybe you mentioned this in your introduction, but I didn't pick up on it. But I was wondering if he's using this patterned language of poetry to create assumptions in the universe that there are these patterns to make his arguments, some of his theological arguments, you know, that custom is law, really, that we to make those decisive arguments.
Good point.
Thank you. So what a wonderful question. So rich and complex and detailed. I think you're right that Pope wants to philosophy on its own can be quite abstract. It doesn't show us the human experience of ideas or of the world. I think the kind of essay that Pope is writing, this verse essay, is about showing us that experience, showing us how humans move from one position to another. And I agree with you. I think that's a pattern. It's not just about the patterning of language, the patterning of language both in the making of lines, which are very memorable and stay with us, but also in making the larger shape of the poem, is absolutely a desire to change the way people are, to change people's behavior. That's the great reforming end of the poet. I mean, Pope has his Roman and Greek models to refer back to. The point of poetry is to delight and to instruct. And instructing isn't just dry. It's not simply the imparting of doctrine that could be repeated, but the demonstration of attitudes and points of view and feelings and thoughts that we can adopt and which will change our lives. I think that is precise. I think that's what Pope means by being an ethical writer. He talks at one point about writing a short system of ethics on the Horatian model, so taking the Latin poet Horace as his model for what ethics are. And I think the ethics there is about changing the way that your reader thinks and acts in their daily lives. I think that is his ambition. So I agree with the proposal that you were making in your question.
Yeah, great point. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
He's a little bit of a stickler because there is Shakespeare purposely, breaks meter when he wants to. And Pope, apparently, when he edited Shakespeare, he corrected, some of the beats of Shakespeare and that. I mean, what gall. it's quite... Although Shakespeare wasn't as popular during his time as he became later. Yeah.
The appreciation was just beginning. And Pope also, one of the other great poets of the early 17th century was John Donne. And Pope did versions of his poems. And he said that the poems of Dr. John Donne versified, as if they weren't verse when he found them.
Donne's great.
All right, moving on to the next question, we have Ariana. So Ariana, I'm going to ask you to unmute.
Okay, hi. Assalamu alaikum. And hello, Dr. Jones. Listening to this discussion, it was really nice. And it kind of reminded me of, among the Muslim circles, we say when two or more people are gathered in the remembrance of God or the discussion of God, it's considered a form of worship. So I kind of regarded it a little bit like that too. But in listening to your input in the discussion about the author, I was just a bit struck about how it seems like you have some understanding of Islam and of the Quran, And so I just wanted to know, in your study, you know, the Enlightenment was a really interesting age of a lot of people were exploring their views of God, other than just talking about philosophy. You know, it seemed like it was a personal journey in a sense for Europe. So I wanted to know how your work on the Alexander Pope, and then also your studies, have contributed to your sort of, if it's not too personal, if to your own personal journey, and like how you sort of how you view God, and if you have a particular religious tradition that you're fond of.
Thank you for the question, and it is a personal question, but I don't hesitate to answer it. I happen to be a person of no particular faith. I was brought up in a broadly Christian environment that had more to do with the Methodist branch of the Anglican Christian Church was the only one with which I had much contact when I was growing up. So I come from no particular faith tradition, but I see a great deal. I suppose I do have social and political commitments which, to my mind, bear comparison with some of the commitments that I see exemplified in people of lots of faiths. I suppose for my personal journey in relation to this text is perhaps seeing how a text which was understood to be very central, to be a very mainstream statement of early Enlightenment philosophical and theological principles, And for that reason, has been regarded as quite dull or uninteresting in lots of English studies departments for a number of years. I wanted to see how it could be made to speak to questions that I felt were interesting and important, as well as questions that were important for a person of Pope's faith and for people of other faiths. And it was wonderful to hear Sheikh Hamza illustrate the connections between Pope's thinking and the Quran. So for me, that was the interesting question, to see how this way of thinking about God as a force that made the universe, something that could be brought together by or improved by love and acts of charity and goodness, and how people attempting to be full people, to be the fullest kind of person they could be, might intuit something of what they should do. So we know that our own perspectives on the universe are limited. We can just, accepting those limits doesn't necessarily mean sitting back and doing nothing. We still want to engage. We still want to try. We still want to exert ourselves as humans in the world. How should we do that? We need to launch ourselves into an inquiry or into an act of faith in some way to try to act. So in quite a secular and socially minded way, those were the kinds of questions that were speaking to me. I mean, it is interesting to place Pope's poem in this bigger history of European Enlightenment thought, which does a little more fully start to think about the relationship between the major world religions, for example, and to see historical connections between them and commonalities in the way in which religious traditions develop. I've just been reading a little recently about a later 18th century linguist and translator and a judge in the East India Company, William Jones, who was also a translator from Arabic as well as Sanskrit and Persian, Persian being the administrative language of the Mughal Empire and therefore of large parts of the territory that the East India Company was responsible for. And he was very interested in understanding, as far as he was able, Islamic legal traditions as well as Hindu legal traditions and thinking about the ways in which, full of injustices as it was to my mind, thinking about ways in which British and Islamic legal traditions might cohabit and in which people might live alongside one another. And I think in some ways Pope's is thinking along those kinds of lines, the kind of big ecumenical tradition. How do we think about the all of those things that are generally true about humans? They're probably going to be true of people of all faiths in all times and all places. And in some ways, that's one of the things the Enlightenment, the Western European Enlightenment, tries to do, to think about humanity in that very general way. And again, thank you for the question, and thank you for sharing your time with me.
Thank you. And just a reminder, we are at the 1.5 hour mark. All right. I have Basman next. I'm asking him to unmute.
Hello. Thank you very much. Assalamu alaikum. You touched upon the question that I was going to ask, but I'm still. And I apologize if this was answered very clearly in the text, but it was my first reading, and so it wasn't clear to me. And from the discussions, maybe it isn't clear. But I see this kind of pushing on the two ends. When two people desire the same thing, conflict occurs, and he's pushing towards the pursuit of virtue. And you kind of mentioned it as well. And I'm looking for, does he discuss or suggest or kind of can we infer from the poem and from the discussions that you've had on the book, can we infer any path or direction that he is pushing people towards? Because you can, it seems like it's almost pursuit of virtue means by default, there's not going to be any conflicts. All those people with A-type personalities who are pushing the envelope, the people pushing technology, even would he have approved of today's advances in technology, knowing that all this competition, all this conflict, all this strife that occurs because of it, where would he push people towards? Like, is there an asymptote from the top and from the bottom that he's pushing people towards? How do we navigate that? How do we understand the text from that perspective?
Great question. Thank you.
Thanks again for another very interesting question. I think my I would say that it's in some of Pope's key metaphors that the answer to this question lies. One of them is the family. So and again, this is I say this without necessarily being, these being my beliefs, but perhaps Pope's beliefs. What makes a king? Well, it's the father of the people. Family life is a kind of model for social life. So I think Pope thinks of families and the love that exists within families and the way in which families function is a model. It's something that can be fallen back on. How if we depart from that kind of familial love in which people love themselves in one another, then something has gone wrong. So it's any moment when people have departed from that. Other examples of these metaphors which are quite powerful are perhaps around agriculture and horticulture, the development of plant life. If we're helping nature on its way, if we're good gardeners, if we're good farmers, if we're bringing things from the resources that nature has given us, we're expanding and developing resources, then we're probably okay. But if we're being extractive, or if we're destroying, if we're then you know. So I think if the question is what does Pope actually think virtue is? I think we go to these key metaphors of familial love and responsibility, gardening and care and the development of agriculture, and there could be others where he talks about the chain of being, that orderly system of hierarchy, which is also a set of obligations and responsibilities for everybody within it. If you think you're not part of the chain, you're wrong. So it's only when you have that sense of your connectedness to the rest of the universe that you could be acting virtuously.
Yeah, great.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for that question too. Is a really interesting. I mean, I think I don't see if you agree with this, but I think he's very much in a virtue ethics tradition. So I'm sure, like Aurelius and Nicomachean Ethics, I mean, these would resonate greatly with him. You know, he'd probably be a friend with Alistair MacIntyre if he was alive today. You know. But from the Dunciad, because he brought up a really important point that I wanted to bring up with you and really forgot, is he seems to be very wary of science and he's very concerned. And I think that's more in the Dunciad. Yeah, I think it's in the Dunciad. But yeah, the end of the Dunciad, he says, in vain, the all-composing hour resistless falls. The muse obeys the power. She comes, the sable throne, behold, of night primeval and of chaos old. Before her fancy's gilded clouds decay and all its varying rainbows die away, which shoots in vain its momentary fires, the meteor drops and in a flash expires, as one by one at dread Medea's strain, the sickening stars fade off the ethereal plain, as Argus eyes by Hermes' wand oppressed, closed one by one to everlasting rest. Thus, at her felt approach and secret might, art after art goes out, and all is night. See, skulking truth to her old cavern, fled. This where it gets interesting. See, skulking truth to her old cavern fled, mountains of casuistry heaped o'er her head. Philosophy that leaned on heaven before shrinks to her second cause and is no more. I mean, that's such a powerful, you know, he's seeing something that I don't even, I mean, Bacon obviously begins this process, so he's aware of what's happening. But for him to see that first cause, the metaphysics, is disappearing from the world, the search for the first primal cause, and now it's empirical science that is beginning to reign supreme. So he's really seeing this, you know, shrinks to her second cause and is no more. Physic of metaphysic begs defense, and metaphysic calls for aid on sense. See mystery to mathematics fly. I mean, that's just such an incredible statement given where we are today, because that's the stem. It's all stem. That's where we're at. And he saw this, you know, in vain they gaze toward, turn giddy, rave, and die. Religion blushing veils her sacred fires, and unawares morality expires. No, nor public flame, nor private dares to shine, nor human spark is left, nor glimpse divine. Lo, thy dread empire, chaos is restored. Light dies before thy uncreating word. Thy hand, great anarch, lets the curtain fall, and universal darkness buries all. I mean, wow. You know, what a vision.
And
For him to see that at that time, you know, Kierkegaard, one of my favorite, it's in his notebooks, but he said that very few people see creeping villainy, because they have neither the imagination nor the dialectical ability. And one of my favorite lines that we didn't look at, but you know, in and I, you know, this is decades ago that this first struck me. He says, you know, vice is a monster of so frightful mien as to be hated needs but to be seen, but seen too oft, familiar with her face, we first endure, then pity, then embrace. I mean, I think he really saw something powerful about what was coming. And Nietzsche obviously is next in line. You know, he sees the same vision, and from a secular atheistic perspective, attempts to give us a solution. But I just you know that those are, I think they're the last lines, aren't they, of the Dunciad? Yeah.
Yes, those are the last lines, and it's a wonderful illustration for you to have brought to us, because in some ways it's the negative image of the end of the Essay on Man, with that opening out of possibilities to the universe, and here's the universe closing in on itself now, when all of the principles have been abandoned.
Order ab chaos, right? I mean, that's he's seeing the chaos emerging. You know, I think Shakespeare in Hamlet sees that you know, because he's got the old world of order, which is his father, and then the new world of power, which is his uncle. You know, and the poison is in the ear, which is such a weird place to poison. You know, it's like the new ideas that are coming in, you know, and then Fortinbras, you know, power. I mean, he actually uses two words of power, fort and brass. You know, he comes in when all the chaos at the end of the play, you know, this is the modern world. Power is going to determine everything because order is lost. And when chaos, people beg for order. And that's when the demagogues come. That's when they show up and they start telling people, we're going to set everything right. We're going to bring back the order.
Hmm. Again, just to go back to one of the points about the about Pope's biographical background and his early life that we started with, when William III, this quite aggressively Protestant monarch, came to the throne in 1688, 1689, one of the first things he did and continued to do throughout his reign was to wage war against France. And a lot of some of the first institutions of British state finance, so the Bank of England, for example, and a modernised stock exchange and so on, were founded to enable William III to wage war against France. So this sense of a new world being founded, a world which does thrive on conflict, which has not learned the lessons of the Civil War of Britain and try to create social harmony and peace and so on, even if that means accepting that, well, the person with four footmen gets to go in ahead of me because I've only got one. We can accept those kinds of injustice because the alternative is anarchy. But I think Pope sees in this kind of modern war machine, which is starting to be born, some of the threats as well as in the world of scientific philosophy, kind of materialistic and mechanical philosophy.
Great, thank you for that question, because you brought up something that I wanted to bring up. Yeah, and any other questions?
Yeah, we can take another.
I hope it's not, with Dr. Jones' permission, I don't want to. I know it's getting late over there. So do you have a few more minutes with us?
Yes, that'd be fine.
Great.
In that case, we do have Mustafa, so I'll ask him to come on.
Hello, thank you for taking my question. So I have a couple questions and one comment. So a lot of discussion on virtue, and we discussed virtue last month in the meditations as well. So question to you, Dr. Jones, do you think Pope also had a Stoic bent, or did Stoicism influence him? Because there was a lot of the same concepts that came in. And then maybe if Sheikh Hamza, you could address, there's a lot of sort of, in our tradition, this notion of the balance, the middle way, the Sirat al-Mustaqim. And is there a reading you would recommend on discussing how to balance the virtues from our tradition? So those were the two questions, and just a comment for future. Perhaps we discuss the question concerning technology by Heidegger sometime, because that'll address this topic that the last person asked on.
Yeah, great suggestion. And I've kind of thought about, you know, Heidegger's on technology, but there's a lot of domain knowledge when you get into somebody like Heidegger. I mean, we have a wonderful annotation, but something to think about. Your response, Dr. Jones?
Yeah, just quickly, thank you. That's a very interesting question as well. I think Pope he's read a lot of those classic Stoic authors, and I think he shares a lot with them, particularly about the ideas of being tested, of being tried. The passage from Seneca that I had in my mind as Sheikh Hamza was talking about, the different kinds of people being a test for one another. Seneca saying, you know, God doesn't, God's favorite people aren't let off. It's precisely his favorite people who get all of the sufferings, because that's a, you know, that's, that enables them to show their strengths. So that sense of, I think Pope has that sense of, shares that sense that human life is a state of probation, as the British said in his period of time, that you're being tested. I think one place where Pope is slightly different is that he has a bit more room for what he calls passion or self-love, that he thinks that an appropriately human life is not necessarily mastering or living without your passions or your self-love, but seeing which virtues can spring from the passions or one's self-love. So I think he's slightly different. He has a bit more room for the way in which, I mean, what he calls self-love, which you might call the desire for self-preservation, or the social appetite. I mean, it's difficult to find an equivalent modern expression for his use of the word. I think he has more time for those things than the Stoics do.
Yeah, great difference, because he's definitely much more yes to life in that way. Yeah. So in terms of there's a great work, if you're interested, the questioner, by Nasiruddin al-Tusi. It's probably one of the finest virtue ethics books written in the Islamic tradition, and it's actually translated, a really brilliant translation, from the Persian. It exists in both Persian and Arabic in our tradition. He originally wrote it in Persian, but there's an excellent Arabic translation that was done about 400 years ago. But that's probably one of the best books that we have on virtue ethics in our tradition. And it's called Nasirian Ethics in English. And I think it's the author, the translator, you know, nobody ever remembers translators, which is one of the great tragedies of being a translator. I think it's Wickens, I think, but it's called Nasirian Ethics, Nasirean Ethics. So next question.
Oh, that was actually our last question.
Oh, okay, great. Thank you, everybody, so much. And I really want to especially thank Dr. Jones, first and foremost, for this extraordinary work that he's given the world, but also just giving us your time and insights and clear love of this amazing poet, philosopher. So thank you so much, Dr. Jones, and I hope one day our paths cross, perhaps in Scotland. I think you're, are you English?
I am English, yes.
Yeah, so, but I'm mostly Irish, but I have Chisholm. My grandmother was a Chisholm from the Highlands, so. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you for having me and for sharing your knowledge, your curiosity, and wonderful questions. And it's been a very interesting experience for me, and has helped me to learn quite a lot about Pope, which I didn't know before. So thank you.
Okay, great. Well, take care, and God bless. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Subhanak Allahumma bihamdika ashhadu an la ilaha illa anta astaghfiruka wa atubu ilayk wal 'asr innal insana lafi khusr illa alladhina amanu wa 'amilu salihati wa tawassaw bil haqqi wa tawassaw bis sabr subhan rabbika rabbil 'izzati 'amma yasifun wa salamun 'alal mursalin wa alhamdulillahi rabbil 'alamin.